Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis, how are you today?
I'm well. I'm well. I'm embracing the green market season.
Yes, it is. I love this time of year.
I have to be honest with our listening audience. I'm embracing it from afar this year. While I have gone to some green markets near my house, we have a wonderful guy that's come back to work with us. He's actually a culinary school student who is going to graduate next year, I believe. He's come back to us every summer, and I hope he comes back and works for us because he's great.
Every summer, every winter.
And he has graduated this year to being our green market go-to guy.
We like the green market go-to guys.
I remember 2 years ago, we were between chefs, and we had a new chef starting over the summer, and so I took that over, and I was the go-to-the-green-market every Wednesday guy. While I have to say, I loved it when I was there.
It's great.
It added a lot. I mean, 5 days a week of radio,
yep,
two restaurants, and going to the green market one day a week, it added a lot to my week, but I loved it when I was there. And now, since I trained Tommy, he goes to the green market. He does a reconnaissance mission. He looks at everything in the green market, thinks to see anything that we might be interested in. Calls the chef or calls me, and says, "Okay, this is what we got. These are the prices." And he came back with scapes last week. I love scapes in the springtime. Should we tell our listeners what scapes are all about?
Of course.
Scapes are on the top of garlic, on the top of green garlic. If you ever see the there's the green thing that's above the ground.
Yeah, it looks a little scallion-like. Looks a little.
And there's a little bulge at the top that is just a little bit more a little thicker than the rest of it.
It's basically something that people were throwing away for a long, 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 long time, and they said, "Hey, that tastes good. Quit it."
And you treat it basically. You treat it like a green bean. You can mash it up. It has a milder, sort of rounder, flatter garlic flavor than a garlic bulb or a garlic clove. It's not as odoriferous. There's a word for you, huh?
Really?
It's not as odoriferous as garlic bulb, and you can eat them like beans. I adore them.
They're delicious.
I adore them.
They're delicious. But this time of year, and frankly, all the way through the summer in this part of the country, I mean, there are certainly people in other parts of the country that have the benefit of doing this for a much longer period than you and I do. But literally every week when you go to the green market, there's something new, there's something exciting, there's something moving into season, something moving towards the end of its season. It's really fantastic. And there's another part of this that I want to talk about just for a second. We're seeing the season being lengthened. We're seeing people do all sorts of I don't want to say tricks because what we're seeing is people trying to do this as naturally as possible. But for instance, the first Jersey tomatoes come up. And what we get them from a place in South Jersey, a place called Cherry Lane Farms. But they're true Jersey tomatoes, because what you'll find is there are a lot of hothouse tomatoes that are grown in pots or hydroponically or lots of different ways to do it. But Cherry Lane Farms grows their tomatoes in the soil. And they cover the area so where they hold just a little bit more warmth. And they get just a little bit more of that kick just in the beginning of the season, so they can be at the beginning of the season. The other thing we do, and in this area, and people who grow just for us, is they will plant late and then do the same thing where they'll put tomatoes into some kind of an area and try and keep them warm a little bit longer to extend the season. So you see people trying to get this season a little longer or start the season a little earlier. Well, one of the great reasons to do that if you're a farmer is because you may be able to get $3 or $4 or $5 a pound for your heirloom tomato at the beginning of the season before anybody else has any.
Mm-hmm.
And you may be able to get $3 or $4 or $5 or $6 a pound at the end of the season when they're out. But during the height of the season, when everybody's got tomatoes,
The prices are really reasonable.
You may be getting $1 or $1.50 a pound at the wholesale level, or maybe $2 a pound. If you can get double that, if you can extend the season, well, there's really some financial incentive to do that.
Well, and there's incentive for you too as the farmer, and for you restaurateurs who listen. Mm-hmm. One of the things we've really gotten into as of last year is we go in when the prices are at their lowest.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when often the quality is at its best.
Sure.
And we go in and we buy from our local farmers, and we buy much more than we can use. When they're perfect. And
that's because we like to throw things away. No,
of course, Mark,
I'm just kidding.
And we put them up. And, you know, you've heard us talk about that through the winter as we, you know, this was the first year we really all winter long kept opening things.
It was a lot of fun.
You know, opening strawberries in January and February, opening 2007 strawberries in January, February 2008 to put on a dish. And the other thing that's really interesting to me, and I'm going to be going to the green market at least a few times, in talking with Tommy about what to source at the green markets, we're not, and what we talk about with our farmers that we work closely with and talk about a planting schedule at the beginning of the year, we're sourcing for the restaurants for this season and for what we want to put up. But the exciting thing that's really new to us is we're sourcing for the bar.
Mm-hmm.
We're sourcing for summer cocktails because we now bring the same sense of seasonality to our bar that we do to the restaurant. And we also use those things that we put up in the bar as well as in the restaurant. And it's an exciting new way to look at things. And I don't think a lot of people are doing that yet.
And the dynamic has changed for us now as we, frankly, Francis and I have gotten a little better at this. In prior years, what we've done is we've said, we found something cool in the green market and say, okay, let's use this in a cocktail. Whereas this year, there's a little bit more, we're able to plan a little better, knowing exactly what's going to come into market. Doesn't mean we won't do that. Doesn't mean when you see a really cool wild blackberry from, or wild slowberries that somebody is growing at some, from some unique place, that we won't use those things. But there's a lot more planning going into, okay, this is the season for blackberry, this is the season for strawberry, this is the season for, we're going to use thyme, simple syrup in a couple of cocktails. It's the dynamics changed a little bit as far as the planning stages go.
And both parts are exciting, that we're planning for things to change and that we'll be caught by surprise sometimes by something at the green market. And we'll say, hey, you know what? Look at that. Those are sugar plums.
Mm-hmm.
You know, let's use those in a cocktail. We got to be able to figure that out.
And remember, sometimes the surprises are, yeah, no more peaches. Sorry.
Yeah, that's true.
Rainstorm, all gone.
But we're looking at a good season this year overall, mm-hmm. and that should be pretty exciting in your restaurant. And if you go to your local restaurant and they're serving California strawberries right now, you might want to suggest to the owner or the maitre d', you know, hey, you know, I had some local strawberries in the market that were, you know, your food's good and all, and I love it, but, you know, why don't you try and buy some local strawberries? Because you, as the customer, it's you who drives the market. Maybe we have a little bit of influence. Maybe we can help you figure out how to have your say and make your voice heard the best. It's all up to you, and it's all up to all of us. Anyway, we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:15. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. Joining us today is George Naylor. He is a farmer from Chardon, Iowa. He's best known as he was featured in Michael Pollan's best-selling book, The Omnivore's Dilemma. For the past 4 years, George has served as the president of the National Family Farms Coalition, which is an organization that works to reduce corporate control of agriculture and promotes a more socially just farm and food policy that favors, what do you know, the family farmer. He joins us today to discuss the current state of agriculture in America and the state of the farm bill and our dysfunctional American farm policy.
George, welcome to the show.
Well, yes, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, George, it's kind of a mess, the farm policy. We talk about things all the time, but you're an actual farmer. You actually grow corn and soybeans. Your family's been farming in Iowa for generations now.
Right.
Can you just sort of give our listeners who may not be intimately acquainted with what's gone wrong, can we talk a little bit about corn?
Sure.
What's wrong?
Yeah, corn is the most widely produced crop in the United States, and it's being produced more and more all over the world. And there's a misconception that farmers raise corn because of subsidies, that like the farm program pays you to raise corn. But that's a little bit not correct. It may appear to be correct, but it's not. the reality is that corn is an amazing plant that has an amazing ability to produce very much protein, carbohydrates, and oil, and it can adapt to many different kind of climates and growing conditions. And if you give it nitrogen fertilizer, particularly artificial nitrogen fertilizer, it'll really produce. So it's an amazing crop. And the thing is, a lot of decisions were made by our ancestors to come out here to the prairie where there was grass growing and plow it up and grow corn. So anyway, it's used mostly, about 5/8 of it is used for animal feed. And the other crop that we raise back here in the Midwest a lot of is soybeans, which comes from Asia. And 99% of the soybeans are used for animal feed.
Well, let's talk about the differences between how corn is raised today in modern agribusiness and how it was raised on small family farms. I mean, there's an ideal of the family farm as this sustainable enterprise that creates foods by taking a lot of the energy from the sun that goes to fix the nitrogen in the soil when we grow beans and crops that fix nitrogen in the soil. We rotate the crops. We grow corn. Feed corn to the animals. The animals, poop and create fertilizer that goes back onto the fields, and we sell meat, right? And that's a fairly sustainable model, isn't it?
Yeah, particularly in past years when the livestock were on family farms,
so,
and when we didn't have a lot of artificial fertilizer.
And so that was the cycle of the family farm, and I think incorrectly it's the idea that a lot of people have in their minds of what American agriculture is today. How has American agriculture changed, and what's made it change?
Well, the thing about agriculture is that it has a tendency to overproduce because farmers can actually externalize their costs. You know, when you think about productivity, that's a common word used when you're talking about the economy. Well, productivity, when you're talking about farming, can mean that you're actually abusing the land or pouring on chemicals or fertilizer to increase your productivity. And so there's a tendency towards that. And the ironic thing is that if farm prices, like the price of corn, goes down, farmers aren't necessarily going to produce less. In fact, in order to stay in business, they might actually try to produce more.
So as prices go down because of overproduction,
right,
what the farmers are forced to do then is actually grow more corn, driving the price farther down in order to just pay their bills.
Right. And you've got big agribusiness companies that are really going to let farmers do that.
They're going to encourage that. They're not going to let them do it. They're going to encourage it.
Yeah, they're going to sell them new technology like genetically modified crops, and they're going to sell more fertilizer and more chemicals and bigger machinery to do that all over the world. On the one hand, and on the other hand, they're going to take that cheap corn and turn it into cheap chickens and cheap cattle and cheap pigs and cheap milk, you know, and cheap eggs.
And cheap Pop-Tarts.
And cheap what?
And cheap Pop-Tarts and Kellogg's Corn Flakes.
Yeah, right. Anything, and corn sweeteners and things.
Right,
so pretty soon the food that we're eating is actually basically manufactured food. It has no relationship to where the corn was produced.
Well, you know, we're going to take a quick break, but I want to come back and talk on the other side. You raised an interesting point about the free market and how it doesn't work with agriculture like it works with other industry. And I want to come back and flesh that point out a little bit with George Naylor in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:24.
Hey, Francis, what's your first choice of hotel in New Jersey?
Easy question, Mark. It's the Heldrich Hotel and Conference Center.
You stay there because it's so convenient, right across the street from the restaurants, right?
I stay there because it's awesome. The rooms are elegant and stylish and comfortable. The service is slick and professional and kind. Did you know they have a swimming pool and a full-service spa? You can get a foot massage.
You know you're a decadent guy, right?
I do, and that's why I stay at the Heldrich.
Well, I stay there for more practical reasons. It's right in the heart of New Brunswick, so you can walk to all the great restaurants and brew pubs and cafes and three world-class theaters. You can even catch the train to Manhattan and be there in less than an hour. And if you want to dine or have a drink in the hotel, Christopher's Restaurant and Bar is right there.
The Heldrich is also great for business. In our dining rooms, we meet a ton of people who book corporate events, meetings, and conferences there, and they're all happy. With 248 rooms, 14 suites, and over 25,000 square feet of state-of-the-art meeting and conference space, the Heldrich can do up to 450 for meetings, social events, and even great weddings.
On the practical side again, it's only 25 minutes from Newark Airport, there's a direct train from New Brunswick, and frequent shuttles. How easy is that?
To plan a meeting or book a leisurely getaway, call the Heldrich at 866-609-4700, visit theheldrich.com, or click through the link on our website, ask for the Restaurant Guys promo, or online enter promo code Catherine to get a special rate just for our listeners. That's 866-609-4700, theheldrich.com, or click the link on Restaurant Guys Radio. The promo code is Catherine. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left in Catherine Lombardi Restaurants. We're talking with George Naylor, immediate president of the National Family Farms Coalition. You raised a point earlier that I'd love for you to flesh out. It seemed to me that what you're saying is because of the nature of farming, you know, in the nature of business, you know, if the price of something goes down, somebody has less incentive to produce it. And so there's a sort of a regulating thing that works in a factory. If the price goes down and the guy can't cover his costs, he makes less of it. And with farms, it's different. If you're a farmer and the price goes too low, what you have to do is try and squeeze to make more, which drives the price downward, which makes you try to produce more until you finally go bust. So rather than making less and less and less and petering out like a factory, a farm makes more and more and more until it goes bust.
And one of the points you made that I thought was really great, George, and I've read a lot of stuff that you've written and said. One of the points you made was, and so the farmer goes bust, but that farm doesn't stop producing corn.
Somebody else takes it over and makes corn with it. So
right.
So the economic model, you're saying that the free market doesn't work with agriculture, or are you
right.
saying that?
Yeah, so many times journalists and things we'll refer to Econ 101, like we're supposed to have learned how the free market works and it works best for everything. But the truth of the matter is that if Econ 101 teaches that it works good for agriculture, Econ 101 is totally wrong.
Well, you know, it's funny because the market is great at making short-term decisions. And you know, people say that real proponents of free market when it comes to agriculture, and Mark and I, if you've listened to the show, you know we're not proponents when it comes to agriculture of free market. But people say the countervailing argument is a rising tide will eventually lift all boats, whereas I say a free market causes a rising tide to cause each boat to smash into the rocks one at a time.
Capsize, exactly.
One at a time it smashes boats into the rocks. Is that a better analogy?
Yeah. It is, because like you say, when one farmer goes broke, another farmer will just take over that land and try to produce the stuff as cheaply as possible again. And the other important thing to realize is that, unlike what we think of as a family farm where the farmer owns the land, today, a typical farm in Iowa, the farmer only owns about 20 to 30% of the land that they farm. And they rent all the rest, sometimes from an absentee landowner that could be thousands of miles away who's demanding that farmer produce the absolute most that they can.
We're going to come back after the news and talk more with George Naylor, who is really at the heart of the American farm as an American farmer, right after the news. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. Time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Today we're talking with George Naylor. He's a farmer and president of the National Family Farms Coalition in Iowa. And we're talking about the way that agriculture doesn't work best in a free market. And I want to talk about the role of the government and the food bill. or the farm bill. We have a huge farm bill. We spend a lot of money subsidizing the cost of corn. But it turns out that in your opinion, subsidizing the cost of corn doesn't benefit the farmers. It benefits the large factories that wind up buying cheap corn, while it sends the farmers into ever and ever greater production at an ever and ever lower profit, and strips the land and forces the farmers off the farm. Is that fair? And can you tell us how that mechanism of that works?
Yes, that's absolutely right. You see, the dirty little secret is that the reason that the farm bill is paying farmers taxpayer dollars is because the farm bill isn't written the way it should be, and farmers generally, not in current times because we're having very high prices right now, but for the last 20 years, for instance, we've had such low prices that the whole farm economy would have collapsed if it hadn't been for the government payments. And so they were able to have their cake and eat it too. Big business was letting the taxpayer spend billions of dollars just to keep the farm economy from collapsing, and therefore they could get the cheap grain at the same time.
But it wasn't making the farmers rich.
No. We actually, if you took into account the money that the farmer got from the federal government, they still, most of the time, were not getting their cost of production.
Well, I looked at some of the statistics here, you know, what it costs to produce a bushel of corn as opposed to what you sell a bushel of corn for, and I think most people would be surprised to realize that it costs more to produce a bushel of corn than you sell a bushel of corn for.
Right. Yeah, that's typically the case.
Well, let's talk let's go back to the 1930s and Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal. That was when the Farm Bill came in to help support American farmers, and it worked for a while, but it worked on a very different model. Can you explain to our listeners how the Farm Bill worked from 1933 to 1953, and then in 1953 we started taking it apart, and in the 1990s we cut the legs out under it entirely, but when it was working, or did it work in the 30s, and if so, how was it different?
Well, like all of the New Deal programs, it was a time of experimentation. But they actually did have the basics figured out, where they recognized that farm prices didn't usually keep up with the cost of farming and the cost of living, because of what I explained earlier. And so what they did was create what's called a price support. They created a mechanism so that there was a floor under prices where the farmer knew that they wouldn't have to take anything less than a certain price, okay, which is like similar to a minimum wage, okay? Mm-hmm. You can imagine if we just lowered the minimum wage overnight, or let's say we did away with the minimum wage, well, you know that every person that went into work the next day would be told that they're probably going to have to work for a couple dollars an hour less, okay? And that would start a downward spiral just like it does in agriculture with agricultural prices. So once you get that floor there, the farmer knows, well, I don't have to go out and exploit my land, you know, to keep up with inflation, for instance. Okay, I can stabilize my farm and I know what's going on here. Okay, that's the first part of it. The second part of it is that in years when there's a really good crop, the excess, the surplus, doesn't have to be dumped on the market which would only drive the price down. That surplus then can be stored. Grain is really the basis of civilization. When you think of it in Mexico and in the Americas, corn created civilization because the Indian people could store that corn from year to year so that if next year they had a drought or a flood or whatever, there would still be food.
But forget about Indian people. This is how our country ran for a long, long time, isn't it?
Right. Yes, and that's how the New Deal farm program was set up. They set up reserves so that we would have stability on the low side of prices, the price support, and then when there was a catastrophe like the Dust Bowl, the corn that was stored in previous years could be brought back on the market to keep the price from going sky high.
Let me give people a better idea of how this used to work. I'm going to simplify it a little bit. The way it used to work was the government, people have a misconception that the government paid farmers to produce corn during the Great Depression, and in fact, they paid farmers to in a way to keep corn off the market. What would happen? See, farmers have a different problem. If a farmer has a bad year when the weather's bad because he has trouble getting enough crops to market, but if the weather's really good and he has too much crop to bring to market, so does everybody else.
Everybody has
and the
too
price
much.
Goes down.
I mean, think about, look at in your supermarket, strawberries during strawberry season, the price goes way down.
And the idea is, you know, when you own a factory, you can adjust your production to the demand. Your production when you're a farmer is due to the weather and your efforts, and what you're going to produce is figured out for you. And then you come to market at a specific time. And what the government did for a long time was it set this floor, and it said to farmers, if the prevailing price of corn or grain is less than this minimum, this floor, we'll either buy it from you at that floor and hold it in case of a rainy day, thereby keeping it off the market and keeping the price from going down lower, or we'll loan you money guaranteed against your corn to hold it for a while, and then you can sell it when it comes back up on the market. So this didn't cost the government a lot of money, because that corn eventually got sold with the fluctuations of the market. What it did was it allowed for some stability so that our farmers could produce food and stay on the farm. And
not sell it below what it cost them
to produce. And I want to talk about what George said as well, is when you have that stability, you can take the long view of your land, because when families own farms, they want to keep them in good condition to pass down to the next generation. When you don't know if you're going to make it, and you're like, listen, we're about to go broke, I got to get every ounce of corn I can out of every acre, then you don't have the luxury of taking the long view and being a good steward.
When you're
land.
Always teetering on the edge, it's a much hard, you have to make harder decisions.
And so, how did the farm bill then change? It went from having this price floor where it sort of guaranteed you a certain price at not great cost to the government, and then what happened?
Well, then big business got its way, and what they did was they propagandized everybody to think about the farm economy in a completely wrong way. They said, oh, look at this. Farmers are producing too much. They must be getting too high a price, so we have to lower the price support. Well, as I pointed out earlier, that didn't make farmers produce less. That actually encouraged them to produce more. So for years and years and years, they used the same logic and got the same result, more production. And they had to have, sometimes they had to have land set-aside programs just to prevent so much corn from piling up, and wheat and soybeans too. So anyway... Let's see, what was I going to say
Well,
here?
We were talking about 1996 with the Freedom of the Farm Act.
Right. Eventually what they did, they were so confident that we could use up all the corn that was produced, they did a completely away with any kind of price support whatsoever, no matter how low it was. The price could go to 10 cents a bushel if it wanted to, and there's absolutely no reserves, and there was absolutely no mechanism for keeping land out of production, except for the Conservation Reserve Program. So it just sort of unleashed the whole farm economy, and farmers were to plant fence row to fence row. And now that's what we've done. We've done that now since 1996. And the crazy thing is that because the price of corn and wheat and soybeans were so low, it created the demand, like through these big factory farms, these livestock farms, to the point, plus the ethanol thing, to the point where we've used up all the corn that's being produced every year. And now we've got a huge weather problem here with these floods, which only compounds it more. So now we're going to end up with not enough corn and soybeans and wheat to go around.
Well, especially when you start talking about corn. I mean, and if you listen to the show a lot, Francis and I talk about this a lot. We overproduced corn so much that it became artificially cheap to put corn sweetener to replace all the other sweeteners that we use, to put corn in our animal feed, to put corn, you know, cows traditionally eat grass, to feed our cows corn, to feed, just to dump corn literally into everything we touch, now has corn or some derivative of corn, usually high fructose corn syrup, in it, because it was so artificially cheap.
Right, and so they even bred the livestock, you know, in ways so that the livestock would eat a lot of corn and not just get totally fat.
You know, when we come back, we're going to talk more about the Farm Bill, and we're going to talk about the idea of free trade and food sovereignty with a great American farmer, George Naylor. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:45. The Feluga family at the Livio Feluga Winery are masters of modern winemaking and at the same time rooted deeply in Italian tradition. Founder and patriarch Livio Feluga has been counted among the seven most influential Italian winemakers in the last 100 years. Signore Feluga pioneered the Friuli method. It's a style of winemaking that focuses on the purity of the fruit and the expression of the soil. It's made Livio Feluga Pinot Grigio the standard bearer for high quality artisanal Pinot Grigio. It's serious, interesting, deeply rooted wine that speaks of the very essence of Friuli, from whence it comes. But with Livio Feluga, it's not only Pinot Grigio. Feluga wines offer a world of adventurous choices. Have you ever had a wonderful Ribolla Gialla or a Picolite? Well, if you haven't, then you're missing some very special Italian wine indeed. Feluga makes red wines like Verdigo, which is Cabernet and Merlot, or Sasso, which is made with the Italian grapes Refosco and Pignolo. Start with Pinot Grigio, the way it's supposed to be, and then, through the efforts of Livio Feluga, take a tour of Friuli, glass by glass, sip by sip. Ask for Livio Feluga wines at your local wine shop, or look for them online. Tell them you heard about it on The Restaurant Guys. Hey everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi, and we're talking with George Naylor, an American farmer, president of the National Family Farms Coalition, and authorities testified before Congress on the farm policies and how the farm bill helps big business and does not help the American farmer at all. We've talked about how a free trade policy when it comes to farming tends to create a race to the bottom as far as prices. And I think that a race to the bottom as far as pricing is concerned with food and with the produce of our farms is not necessarily a good thing. I mean, you can argue whether or not among toy factories, if the cheapest place to produce all the toys in the world is China, then all the toy factories move to China. There are no more toy factories left in America. If we head for a race for the cheapest place to produce everything, doesn't that spell the end of the American farm at some point when we exhaust the land and it's just not worth it to produce corn here anymore?
Yeah, there's a professor in California that has written a paper that says exactly that. And so when you think about how our land is used for development and things like that, there's no way that you can have the cheap prices for agriculture and the high price for land that we experience in this country. So, yeah, most of our food will end up being produced overseas in ways that we don't even know, and a lot of land in this country then will also be, some of it will still be producing food, but it's obviously going to be in an industrialized manner, where the only consideration is producing the most for the least amount of money, and that's all. There will be no such things as small farms. There will be no small rural communities based on agriculture anymore.
George, I think that some of our listeners are surprised, given your philosophies here, that you grow corn and soybeans. You wanna tell why we grow corn? Why are you growing those crops?
Right. Well, like I said, the thing about corn and soybeans and wheat is that they're non-perishable. You can store them from 1 year to the next. So in effect, there's always a market for those products. Somebody will buy them if they make them cheap enough, and you can store it then, thinking that you'll sell it later. And whereas with perishable commodities like strawberries or broccoli or something like that, you have to have the market figured out in the short run. And if you don't get it sold at a price that you can live with right away, it's going to sit there and rot within a week or two, you know.
And if there's not that infrastructure, there's simply nothing you can do. You can't get it to market
in
time to use it.
Right. And so you know, out here in the middle of nowhere, out here in the prairie or whatever, we're not going to have enough markets to sell locally. Some people are doing that, and it's a wonderful thing that they are, and we should be encouraging local production all over the United States. And that's how to swim against the tide, that's for sure.
We talk about that, and we do that all the time, every day, and God bless you, you're absolutely right.
Right. But it's a very difficult thing to do, especially as far as perishable, you know, fruits and vegetables go. You need to have that market figured out. You have to have customers that are loyal to you. And so I really appreciate what the efforts that you folks have put into that.
Well, talk to us about the town of Chardon, where you live in Iowa, and how it's changed over the last 30 years.
Yeah, well, when I was in grade school back in the 1950s, there were 50 kids in my grade, which was just for Chardon. And then before I left school in Sudan, the school joined with Peyton, another town. And now, today, Peyton and Sudan still have their school together, but instead of 50 kids in a grade, they're lucky to have 10 for two towns, when we used to have 30 to 50 kids for one town.
I'm sorry. So farmers are just, small family farmers are simply just leaving, and
and
land is being consolidated.
Right. There are so few family farmers left, and most of the people that live in town are retired farmers or, you know, other people that don't really have anything to do with agriculture anymore. Young people.
Let me ask you a question. In the current political climate, is there one party or one candidate or a group of parties or candidates who's better on farm bill and on agriculture policy than the other?
I wish I could say there was, but there really isn't. If you'll notice, the farm bill usually passes with a bipartisan coalition of votes, and there's usually a certain amount of drama created sometimes with the White House, or the White House threatens to veto it. But it's a lot like you're watching big time wrestling on TV, you know, it's all fake.
We're going to run out of time with the live broadcast, but would you stay with us, George, after the live broadcast is over? And so our podcasters, I want to get into a little bit more of the farm bill and why it seems like our politicians are overlooking the logical conclusion of what the farm bill should look like.
Right, yes, and I think that's really important in this time when we're facing a shortage of grain, and we have no idea what the next year might bring.
Well, you know, we're going to take a short break now on the broadcast. We'll come back afterwards. Tune into the podcast at restaurantguysradio.com, and you can hear more of our discussion with George Naylor. We'll be back in just a moment for our CTC listeners. 1450 WCTC, the time is 11:55. Hello, podcast listeners, and welcome back. This is the podcast-only section of the continuation of the George Naylor Show. George, we were talking about food sovereignty, and we were talking about how, you know, the farm bill always passes. There's so much money in agribusiness, and so many people are so invested in cheap grain, cheap corn for food agribusiness. But, you know, what's the political awareness of small farmers out there? Do people know what's in their best interest out there? Are people working to change this? Are the farmers completely voiceless? Are they united on this?
You know, it's a sad deal. You know, our coalition, the National Family Farm Coalition, does have groups in 30 states, and we do our best to get the word out and to give farmers a voice in this whole situation. But the truth of the matter is that farmers aren't really organized like you think. And besides that, there are organizations that claim to represent farmers that really represent agribusiness. Mm-hmm. They take money from agribusiness. They have promotional programs that go right along with agribusiness, and they don't question the free market whatsoever.
Are there small family farmers who act against their own self-interest who join these groups and buy their viewpoint, propaganda,
sure,
whatever you want to call it?
Sure, there are. You know, I mean, it's an easy thing to say, oh, yeah, we just want to let the free market set things up. And then, you know, historically, too, look back at the early 1950s when the New Deal farm programs were dismantled. You were in the middle of the Cold War. And so at the time, they used McCarthyism to destroy the farm organizations that really represented farmers, like the National Farmers Union. They cut the legs off from under the National Farmers Union by accusing it of being a communist organization. Hmm. So, you know, farmers tended not to join that,
mm-hmm.
that there wasn't really any organization that really represented farmers.
But here's the part of this I don't understand. Mm-hmm. If you were to go out and take a poll of every American in the country and say, do you think that having small family farms is important to the country? I'm sure 60 or 70 or 80% of the population would say, yes, I believe it's important to have small family farms in the population.
Yeah.
Then you drop this bill in their lap, which basically says, hey, you know what, let's, and it's it clearly, I mean, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to read this bill and say, okay, this bill is geared towards, let's see what we can do to have the, have giant, huge conglomerates plant lots of monocrops and not have the family farm with crop rotations and, like we talked about, having some livestock.
Diversification, rural communities.
You know, and if people, again, would you prefer that you eat a pig that comes from a family farm or that's grown in a factory in a cage where it can't turn around? You know, 98% of people would say, I'd rather pay a little more for the pig that grew up on a farm. It's probably going to taste better, and I certainly can't even imagine eating a pig from one of these factories. Yeah. Yet we have this bill that gets passed by our politicians. I truly, and I understand, you know, that there are dollars and cents in this, and that people are funding people's campaigns, and people are throwing a lot of money at this.
Mm-hmm.
But where are the people to speak out about this and say, you know what, we want our voice to be heard?
Right. Well, the last time that happened was in the 80s when there was a farm crisis, and we did have a real family farm movement then. Senator Harkin was our champion back then, but, you know, he hasn't been since. So it's just really hard. They have a way of, through the media, through all the local farm newspapers and whatever, of sticking to the line that the free market's the best.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, it's just that there's just a huge propaganda machine, you know.
Well, you know, part of the propaganda machine, the thing that I keep hearing is that, well, government doesn't work. Let's get government out of the way and everything will be fine. Well, you know what? Government does work sometimes. The New Deal did work for a while. And there are some things that the free market does best, but there are other things that the government is – why we have a democracy, I believe anyway, is because the government is important and is tasked with some very important things that it has to do. And – government should step in here. For instance, if government had stepped in and we had a price floor, we would have a national reserve of grains like corn. And so right now, we wouldn't be experiencing the price spikes that we're experiencing because with the food crisis in the country and with the rising cost of food in the country, and we're in the restaurant business, we see that. Because at this point, the government will be taking those stocks that they have been stockpiling for the last many years and releasing them back into the market to stabilize the price. And it would work well on both sides, and it wouldn't cost anything.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there will be a lot of these, you know, livestock factories closed down, and ethanol plants are already closing down because the price of corn is so high.
Mm-hmm.
So these people have talked themselves into a corner. They don't even realize that you know, they cooked their own goose on this whole thing.
Well, the problem here is, and I'll tell you, for most things in the world, I think the free market is a great system, and I think it works very well. But part of the free market just simply has to be, and it hasn't been for a long time, is that business and big business and big farms pay the true cost of what they're creating.
Right.
And if you're dumping nitrogen into the soil and dumping and dumping and dumping, you know, there's a cost to that to society. There are costs to that, and we haven't really gotten a chance to talk about that very much.
I think you know, seeing what role government needs to play is really an important question, and I think it's pretty well recognized that when it comes to the environment, the federal government has a really important role. I mean, you can't let the polluters be the winners in the economic system, so we have to have the government say, no, there are limits to what you can do polluting. It's the same way with agriculture, because really that's what it's all about. As a farmer, sure, you can go out and be more productive, whatever, but it's at the cost of the environment.
Right. There are additional costs there, and you need, and again, even for me, who's relatively, again, not so much in food and family farms, but relatively a free market guy, that's fine as long as people are paying the costs. Okay, there is a cost to society to having a huge farm produce as much corn as they possibly can for 20 years, and then that land is completely burned out. There's a cost.
Well, And because the other side of it is that when that happens, the livestock is not going to be on the family farm. The livestock is going to be in this great big huge feedlot or this great big huge building.
Exactly. That's and part of the cost.
You see, yeah, and that manure then isn't even anywhere near where the land was that produced that corn, so it can't be returned to the land and be used as fertilizer. It just ends up to be a pollutant.
Now it becomes toxic waste. Let's talk about the situation now of these intensive farming operations that we have now and the amount of nitrogen fertilizer we have to throw on the ground. It causes a real problem on family farms and in towns that are located near farms and in rivers around. What are the ecological implications of being on a farm now that you know, with the water supply and the like, and being in a town near a farm now, that may be different than it would have been in, say, 1945.
Right. Well, in the old days, there was so much more biological diversity. Of course, people didn't even know that term back then, but it was very apparent. When I was a kid, we had wild strawberries growing in our ditch, and my grandfather would pick mushrooms, you know, and things like that. And it was a much more pleasant environment. You had diversity there and different kinds of crops. You had hay and pasture and different kinds of livestock and, you know, the county fair and the whole family, the whole community were tied together. And now it's just a few big farms raising corn and soybeans and the livestock. You hardly ever see any cattle or hogs on farms anymore and hardly any chickens. Those are all behind walls in great big buildings where the livestock doesn't even see the light of day.
Which in turn makes it less desirable for someone to open a farm, to begin farming and start a family farm.
Now, are you saying that the strawberries and mushrooms and stuff you can't be found anymore?
Right, yeah, they're almost all gone.
Now,
yeah.
And I understand that living in farm communities in Iowa, especially at certain times of year, the water can be tainted.
Yes, well, nitrates end up in both in our streams and in the groundwater. So if you have a well, it could easily be contaminated with nitrates. And of course, the river too. It goes down like our Raccoon River. We'll have levels of nitrates that goes down to Des Moines, and Des Moines has to invest in a huge machine that takes nitrates out of the water, so that babies in Des Moines won't get sick drinking.
Shouldn't that be an expense? And this goes back to what we were talking about before. Shouldn't purifying that water be an expense to Cargill and Monsanto and
or the family
Archer
farms
Daniels?
Right.
Yeah. Exactly.
Which would in turn make it less expensive for a family farm to continue to operate because the true cost of operating one of these gigantic farms would truly be there.
Right. Yes. Exactly.
Well,
yeah, that's for sure.
You know, and I remember reading in the book, Michael Pollan's book, in which you were featured, The Omnivore's Dilemma. He talked about there being, because nitrates, when you get too much in the water, they bond to hemoglobin and keep the hemoglobin from being able to carry oxygen. They'd issue blue baby alerts so that to be sure that when there was a lot of runoff in that particular season, you didn't feed your kid water out of the tap because they might not be. They might die. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's accurate. That's why Des Moines has this huge, very costly system to take nitrates out of the water.
That's just crazy. So what's the prescription? Is there any hope? Is there any hope for public policy? Can it be done without public policy change? And is there any hope for a public policy change?
Well, it absolutely needs to be public policy. We need to, like you say, pursue food sovereignty so that every country, every region can figure out what's the best kind of agricultural system for their locality. I mean, people should not be dependent on food that was raised thousands of miles away in methods that you know are destructive. And the farmers in various countries shouldn't have to compete against that. That's one thing for sure. And of course, like there does need to be food reserves. There could be two or three big disasters
George, we got a little bit of Iowa wind blowing up in there in the background.
Okay, sorry, there we go. Okay.
All right, so okay. Why don't we go back and say let's start that question again? So, so George, what's the prescription for change? Is there hope of change? I mean, can it be done without public policy? Can it be just be done by consumers making better choices? And if it does need public policy, is there any hope for that happening?
Well, I would think that given this food crisis now, people might be focused on some of the solutions and recognize that the basis for civilization is to have food reserves and to treat agriculture as a very special aspect of society. So I think there could be, but on the other hand, they just passed a farm bill that totally ignored that. And so we need to tell Congress to go back, write a new farm bill, provide for reserves and a price support so farmers can be sure to stay on the land, and to afford the same kind of respect for agriculture in every other country. In other words, they need to have food sovereignty so that they can have an agricultural system that makes sense with their environment and their society and culture and tradition.
Is the farm bill that was just passed total crap?
Yeah, it's total crap. What they always do is they'll throw in a few little bitty programs that they might encourage, like the food, the cafeteria type programs, or some kind of direct marketing things. But those things cost just a few million dollars, you know, and they're not much more than pilot programs.
You know, George, if you feed your chickens a little bit of corn and a lot of crap, you don't get very good chickens.
Right.
Now yeah. let's talk about immigration, which uh-huh. is, you know, we have what was a lot of the immigration that we're seeing into the United States is strangely Mexican farmers who are being forced off their farms by the low cost of American corn, undercutting yeah. their ability to stay on their own farms in Mexico, and then, you know, they come here, and then a lot of folks are angry and discriminate against them. Did I get that right?
Oh, yes, that's right, and it's happening all over the world. Farmers and rural people are leaving their communities to find jobs in big cities, and if it means crossing a border, well, so be it. Sometimes they'll take the risk, you know. It's a total question of balance. The rural economy needs to be in balance with the rest of the economy. Otherwise, you're just going to depopulate the rural communities in every country and send them to big cities to get a job and be totally dependent on that job to have something to eat, which makes, you know, a stark situation when it comes to this food crisis, because there's a lot of people around the world that might not have a job and they don't have the food stamps or social safety net that we might have in this country.
Hey, George, let me ask, if we're going to put up a website or someplace that our listeners can go to maybe be of help either financially or by taking some action, where could we send them?
I'd say the National Family Farm Coalition website. That's www.nffc.net.
Well, we'll certainly put that up on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. God bless you and the work that you do.
George, I got to tell you, you're not just shouting into the wind. We're listening.
Good. Well, I'll tell you folks, you understand this issue much better than 99.9% of the people I've ever talked to on the radio.
Well, I hope that maybe our combined efforts can make some action happen and maybe do something about it. Keep fighting the good fight.
Yeah, I hope I can come out and have something to eat at your restaurant someday.
Hey, man, whenever you're in, like, the New Jersey, New York area, you're going to have my email. So by all means, come on out. I'd love to sit down and break bread with you.
Okay, great. Thank you.
We're going to put that up on our website. George Naylor is featured in Michael Pollan's book, The Omnivore's Dilemma. He is right at the center of everything that needs to happen.
One of the most important voices in our farmland today. One of the trends that he's resisted is planting genetically modified crops. George has resisted that, and he's not growing genetically modified crops that may allow him to have higher yields. And what he said is, you know what, by the time my next-door neighbor pays the extra for the genetically modified crops, you know, he's really not getting any more profit out of it anyway. The only person that's profiting out of that, or organization, because there really is no person profiting out of that, are these large agribusiness concerns.
Well, let me point out that the way this is set up is to subsidize corn, not to subsidize the farmer, and to not set a price floor. So that subsidy leads to lower and lower prices of corn. And in agriculture, you have a spiral to the bottom. Well, who does that benefit, that subsidized cheap corn? More corn cheaper doesn't benefit the farmer. It benefits corporate agribusiness, who gets to buy the starches they need to make the rest of our
food. Or the person
cheap.
Who's producing the genetically modified corn that will give you more production. So they're getting it on both ends. They're getting it on selling the farmer the seed and the fertilizer, and on the other side of cheaper corn prices.
It's broken. We need to fix it. We need your help. I hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 12 noon.